listening to Regional Originals, a Masters of the Stage podcast. Regional Originals is a series of interviews with some of the most exciting directors and choreographers working in America's regional theater today.
All right. Hi, I'm M. Graham Smith, and this is Masters of the Stage Regional Originals brought to you by the SDC Foundation. Our guest today is Pam McKinnon. She won the Tony and Drama Desk Awards and received an Outer Critics Circle Award nomination for her direction of Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which began at Steppenwolf Theater Company and Arena Stage before arriving on Broadway. She won an Obie Award for Excellence in Directing, as well as Tony and Lucille Lortel Award nomination for Bruce Norris's Clyburn Park, which began at Playwrights Horizons and Mark Taper Forum before hitting Broadway. She has far too many credits to name here, so I'll just mention a fraction of her greatest hits. Pam has directed extensively off-Broadway and around the country, including Manhattan Theater Club, Roundabout Theater Company, Atlantic Theater Company, Primary Stages, Labyrinth, South Coast Rep, Geffen Playhouse, The Old Globe, Magic Theater, Philadelphia Theater Company, Goodman Theater, Alley Theater, Signature Theater, Arena Stage, Hartford Stage, and Second Stage Theater. McKinnon received a San Francisco Bay Area Theater Critics Circle Award for Amelie, a new musical, which premiered at Berkeley Repertory Theater before heading to Broadway, a Joseph Jefferson Award for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf at Steppenwolf Theater Company, and a Helen Hayes Award for Bruce Norris's Unmentionables at Woolly Mammoth. McKinnon is an alumna of the Drama League, Women's Project Theater, Lincoln Center Theater Directors Labs, and she is an artistic associate at Roundabout Theater Company, executive board president of the Stage Directors and Choreographers Society, and former chair and now advisory board member of Club Thumb, a New York downtown theater company dedicated to new American plays. She is now serving in her first season as the new artistic director of San Francisco's American Conservatory Theater, where she just opened her first production, Edward Albee's Seascape, which famously features human-sized talking lizards. Thank you so much for joining us, Pam.
Nice. Nice to be here in my office.
Yes, on a rainy San Francisco day.
This is my first office ever.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful office.
Thank you.
It's got a great view of Chinatown and the bay out the window.
That's right.
The first question that I always ask all our guests is just to tell us a little bit about where you're from and where you found the theater or how the theater found you.
Yeah, I grew up in two cities. I grew up in Toronto, Canada, and Buffalo, New York. So I'm a Great Lakes kid. And as a little kid, I had a bit of a stutter, but my stuffed animals and my puppets didn't stutter. So that was sort of an extension of myself that, in retrospect, feels very important to the theater. I wrote a lot of plays as a little kid, and then it was really in junior high school, so in suburban Buffalo, where I started acting because some of my friends started acting, you know, very social for me. And in seventh grade, the junior high that I was attending, public school, lost its funding for its drama club, and I had a very entrepreneurial friend, Bill Crosby, who said, well, but the show must go on, and he raised money, and we did plays across the street from the junior high for years after that, and it was called the Clarence Young Actors. We were in Clarence, New York, and he was just this entrepreneurial kid. I mean, we're all 14, 15 years old, or even younger, 13, 14, 15, and we did, like, George M. Cohen's 45 Minutes from Broadway. He was in contact with, got the rights to adapt A Wrinkle in Time. Yeah, no, there was like a 3.5 hour theatrical extravaganza, an adaptation of A Wrinkle in Time. Madeleine Le Guin didn't let us videotape this, but we audio taped it. And, you know, so, I mean, just like kind of amazing stuff. We also did The Wizard of Oz. I mean, just a lot of shows. And then in high school, I also was very much involved with the drama club. I also played the viola, so I was both a drama kid as well as an orchestra kid. And in my senior year of high school, I directed the first play that I was to direct, and it was Pullman Car Hiawatha by Thornton Wilder. So something of a sketch or a notion that ultimately became Our Town.
Yes.
And I also acted in it because I know some German, and there's a German character who comes in and performs the planets. So I could at least like say the words on the page and sound German. But that was the first time I directed. So that was.
That's amazing. It sounds like one of the coolest young theater companies I've ever heard of.
Clarence Young Actors, they were the best.
Is there a play or piece of art that's changed your life?
Wow. I certainly remember a problematic summer in Madrid when actually I dropped out of a PhD program in political science, right. And I spent a lot of time at the Prado, and in particular just living in the room with Picasso's Guernica. I don't think it made me drop out of political science, but there was something. I went back to that room a lot, and it's actually contained in a building on its own, and you can see process. You can see all his sketches for all those amazing characters and nightmarish horror that then he put on this giant canvas, and I definitely remember returning to that and just feeling very moved by the scale, by the content, and by learning the process of it.
That's a big transition to make from going far down the road toward a doctorate in political science and then deciding to let go of that and to go on to have one of the most successful careers in contemporary theater. What was the instigation for that switch?
I was in UC San Diego, and I moved to California sight unseen, having gone to the University of Toronto and grown up in Buffalo. So, a little bit fish out of water, or maybe a lot fish out of water. Breaking up with an important college boyfriend. My parents were getting a divorce. So there was a lot of Like the world was in flux for me. And then I was in a PhD program on the heels of undergrad. So I was the youngest kid in that program. And, I'd always been a good student. I had some very good professors in college. And, interested in storytelling, but sort of in college moved away from theater and literature and started focusing on political science. And my father was an academic, so it was sort of like going into the family mm-hmm. business. And then partway through studying there, I realized, the stories are getting smaller for me because the social sciences have to be about cause and effect. And to actually, document causation, you have to ask very specific questions.
Yes.
And my questions were too messy and they were too big. I started to really feel that, especially after the coursework was starting to wind down, that it was no longer about fulfilling assignments, that I had to really own these questions.
Yeah.
And they didn't feel compelling to me. And I had to really rethink, it's not about, pleasing externals or getting serious with respect to like what you're doing. It's like, what is my relationship to this thing? And, I had this amazing summer in Madrid, horrible summer in Madrid, where I just had to really figure out, when was the last time I felt like a self-starter?
Mm-hmm.
And it was really working on theater. And I recognized that I wasn't an actor, though I like performing, but I wasn't an actor. And I thought, I think I'm a director. So that's where it really, came about. And I then I mentioned this to some friends and they were sort of excited and they confirmed like, we've been waiting for you to say this. So that was sort of a revelation of, what do you mean you've been waiting for me to say this? And then I came clean with some advisors at the UC San Diego campus and they were happy for me. And then I had this great transition year in San Diego of signing out cabaret space on campus because I still had a student card.
Yes.
And I assisted Ann Bogart. I assisted Des McAnuff because one of his NEA TCG observers didn't show up.
Awesome.
Like I started directing in parking lots. I met some MFA acting students like Maria Stryer, who continues to be one of my dearest friends, who ultimately co-founded Clubbed Thumb in New York.
Yeah.
I mean, so it was a big pivotal, you know, it was you know, very traumatic because it was changing careers, but I was only 23, 24. And, you know, so looking back on it, more like changing majors, even though
right.
it was bigger than that. But, yeah, I had this great transition time.
That's fabulous. You just mentioned Club Thumb, and it's a good time to just ask you a little bit about the focus of the season is all about new play directing. And one of the things that I think is freeing sometimes about working on classics is if the writer isn't around anymore, kind of have license to really put your stamp on something as a director. But working on new plays requires maybe a different skill set. I don't know if that's how you see it, but certainly your work at Club Thumb, which is a New York company dedicated to the development of new American plays, has a very terrific track record of creating new work and generating new work for the American theater. Can you talk a little bit about Club Thumb and maybe adjacent to that, just how you approach new plays?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Club Thumb is now in its 25th or, oh, I don't know, 22nd, 23rd, something like that, you know, sort of season. And really the cornerstone of its programming is a summer play festival. It's all new work. It's all American playwrights. They also have, and it came about out of necessity, they produce plays that are intermissionless, that are sort of 95 minutes and less. And this came about because of space rental, you know, sort of renting spaces in expensive cities like New York. The original Summer Works festivals had both a main stage time as well as a late night series, and so you couldn't have a 2.5 hour play and have two productions, you know, running in an evening. So this intermissionless, you know, play form became what they now champion. And I was really lucky to arrive in New York while this company was just beginning. I think I directed 7 of the first 9 plays that they did because I was the director.
Right.
And it was co-founded by 2 actors who had gotten their MFA out of UC San Diego, Meg McCary and Maria Stryer. And it was the first time I'd ever worked with living writers. And I think the first play I directed with them was by Aaron Courtney.
Courtney.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so it was, you know, this amazing opportunity. Well, actually, I guess the first play I directed, the first play I directed with a writer in the room was Aaron Courtney's play. I think it was called Summer Play. The first play I directed on one of their late night things was a Chuck Mee play called Constitutional Convention. And Chuck is the kind of writer, you know, very excited to have his work done, who sort of said, have at it. And I think he came to see a performance. So that was, you know, very liberating. Aaron was also very liberating, but in a different way of having, you know, the playwright sort of always seated to my left in the room. And she was rewriting as we were experimenting. And, you know, the play sort of unfolded and developed while we were in rehearsal. And I like going back and forth between those two, you know, yeah, those, you know, sort of toggling back and forth between what those rooms can be and what my responsibility is. I mean, I always feel, you know, I just directed Edward Albee's Seascape, not a new play. And this was the first Albee play that I've directed where after Edward has died and,
right.
and not involved at all
right.
in either the formulation of it or in the rehearsal hall process. But, you know, I definitely take on the responsibility of mining that writer's intent. So, you know, I don't actually feel that differently. You know, I guess I feel, you know, the sort of modes of operation are different if it's Bruce Norris, Aaron Courtney, Jordan Harrison, Edward Albee, Lydia Diamond, because they're different people.
Right.
Not because they're sitting next to me or because they're not. You know, just the conversation gets different because they're different people. We develop different rhythms. But I do see my job always as like going as far with the intent of the writer as possible. I've directed only one fully realized Shakespeare play, Othello, you know, and certainly took out my pen and edited, you know, some parts away. So that does feel different.
Yeah.
You know, I've mainly cut my teeth on contemporary and modern plays, and mainly American at that.
How do you know if a play is right for you to direct when you read a new play, when you read one of the writers that you just mentioned? How do you understand whether or not you feel like this play is for you?
Yeah, I mean, there's something that I literally feel that feels propulsive when I'm reading it for the first time. That if, you know, if reading a play requires, you know, getting up and making a cup of tea and then going back to it, it's probably not for me, because I'm going to be spending weeks, if not months, if not years, invested in this world. And it's a mixture of both content as well as, you know, I guess form, or, you know, as well as, you know, sort of language. Get really jazzed by, there's that language and that music that I want to surround myself with for weeks, months, or years. And content is important too. And character is important, you know, always. But there is something about the music of something that kind of carries me into a play further than just story.
That's so interesting, because of what you had said earlier about the cello and
your viola.
Viola and your musical background.
Yeah, maybe.
Fascinated by the other disciplines that sometimes directors bring to bear in their work. What's your rehearsal room like? What would someone expect to notice when they came into one of your spaces that you're rehearsing something?
I invite conversation. I'm pretty relaxed. I can bear a lot of the possible pressure. I like to laugh a lot in rehearsal, because what we're doing is fun and funny. I also gravitate, you know, toward plays that have that in them, a sense of humor, a sense of the absurd, even if we're going to dark places. I like to laugh a lot. I have huge respect for actors. I try to use the time that we're allotted. So, you know, if it's a four-hour rehearsal that culminates in a reading behind music stands, I try to use that time and give the six notes that I think are the important notes, and have hopefully cast, you know, quote unquote, the right actors for the roles that they can, you know. I mean, I remember once with Itamar Moses sort of, you know, coming up with some kind of shorthand for sort of reading process, sort of like the final note to give to an acting company is speak quickly and want something. You know, we don't actually have time to discuss what that want is.
Yep.
And we don't have time to pull it apart and own, you know, the emotional space to, like, draw stuff out. So, dear God, just speak quickly and want something.
Yes.
You know, so that can get you through, you know, a half day with a play to read and just bounce up there in front of, you know, a handful of people or a few handfuls of people. But then, you know, if you have a four-week rehearsal process on a big play, let's spend some time in the weeds. You know, and that's what, you know, certainly weeks two and three are about. And, you know, and definitely trying to come up with, like, collectively, what is the story we're trying to tell? You know, I try to come in prepared with my own notions of where we're going. But, you know, I believe I honor that, you know, that best idea in the room wins. And want that to be what my room is about.
That's great. How about designers? How do you deploy your designers to respond to the material? Often, you know, months before the actors get involved in their process of understanding. How do you like to work with designers?
Yeah, I mean, you know, ideally there is a trust factor, you know, but I don't necessarily work only with, like, the same cadre over and over again. I do like, you know, sort of having a constellation of people around me, let's say one person that I've worked a lot with, one person I'm getting to know, and one new person. Yeah. Like, that can be a really exciting group for me.
Yeah.
You know, most recently I directed Seascape, and the first meeting that David Zinn and I had face-to-face was actually with the other designers present, which is can be hard sometimes to accomplish, but we were able to get the full cohort there. And then eventually that lighting designer had to drop out because her show fast-tracked to Broadway and so brought in a different lighting designer. Isabella Bird was my lighting designer, and I'd never worked with her, but I'd seen her work. And then Brandon Ames, who is local Bay Area sound designer, happened to, you know, was in New York, and so was able to, you know, be at that original meeting. But, you know, and I sort of start with the set, like, what is the world we're walking in?
Yeah.
It's sort of leading some design conversations, but we talk about tone, talk about, you know, sort of the spine of the story. With Seascape, David Zinn actually brought to the table, and I'd worked with David a lot, he brought to the table that in the first paragraph in Seascape as written, there's this sentence, the curtain rises, and we felt that that sort of liberated us to put the sand dune in a theater.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of, and we talked about, you know, it's really just an encounter between two couples, so it could be in, you know, sort of a gloriously simply realized sky and floor scape. And then we talked about it could be realized in something that is a naturalism, that is a sand dune and with grasses and a beautiful blue psyche that could also be very beautiful.
Yeah.
But then this whole thing of the curtain rises sort of led us to want to be in an in-between and really honor that it took place in a theater. So that's the road we went down. So it is always going back to the text.
Yes.
You know, and sort of talking like the big picture. It's an encounter between two couples and an investigation within a marriage.
Yep.
And so that we want to make sure that, and I also was really interested in pushing that forward into the laps of the audience. So we talked a lot about pushing, you know, the action downstage. And then the curtain rises, we sort of start to talk about, he sees it, the playwright sees it taking place in a theater. And that was the beginning of putting a sand dune into the completely unmasked, you know, portion of the Geary. You know, I also felt as new artistic director, first time directing in what is now my home theater, the main stage of my home theater, to sort of honor that room and also just show off that room in a way that I've never seen, and, you know, maybe the audience even coming for 50 years, rarely seen, if ever. And we have this beautiful show curtain.
Yes.
So the curtain rose, and in it was a sand dune. You know, some people, I think Brandon, our sound designer, said it to him when he first saw it, it felt like a theater had been built around a sand dune, which I kind of really dug.
It's an astonishing moment when the curtain rises.
Yeah.
There's like almost a three-story tall sand dune rendered in like hyper-realism. Mm-hmm. And then this like darkness all the way to the back wall, which you can see, you know, all the details of the fly system and the rails and the graffiti.
And there's some graffiti from the 1920s.
Yeah.
And it's very exciting to me to sort of like, you know, I feel like there's an ongoing project of mine. I'm interested in really embracing these rooms.
Yeah.
I mean, now that I'm also in charge of real estate, and that's what theaters are, and theaters are rooms to tell stories in, and I want us to, you know, not sort of passively consume, but actually be in the room together. So that was sort of part of that as well. Now, I'm also in the process of, I've directed a new play by Bruce Norris, and, you know, we really wanted, it takes place in a four-bedroom, you know, sort of lower middle-class kind of tract housing, basically living room with kitchen and, you know, sort of hallway toward more bedrooms, and we wanted that fully realized.
Yeah.
So, you know, I also like going back and forth, you know, so with Todd Rosenthal and Bruce Norris, because Bruce really, you know, has a visual eye as a playwright. You know, we looked at a lot of different photos of like what is, you know, what is the pile of the carpet and, you know, what is the little archway that goes into the kitchen? How much of the kitchen do we get to see? How is, you know, how fully realized is fully realized? And we just kept on getting more and more and more fully realized. And we're about to hop that Steppenwolf production to the National Theatre in London, and we're even going to have a roof because it's at the Dorfman. It's a taller space. And so we're going to even complete that very fully realized room, living room, front door with, you know, sort of hallway to places beyond. We're going to like make the external surround also, you know, sort of hyper real. So that feels exciting sometimes too.
That's so thrilling. So now you are in charge of real estate, which is the business that the regional theaters are in. I'm curious, you know, after a string of winning a lot of awards for Broadway productions, you've chosen to lead a regional theater, which is 3,000 miles from Broadway. And this program is about the regions. So I'm just wondering, you know, you haven't been here very long, but in the short time that you've been here, I know you've been doing a lot to get to know the city. I'm curious what your sense of what characterizes this region in terms of its theater-going appetite and interest and curiosity.
Yeah, I mean, I've now been here 6 months, with one window when I hopped away to direct this play in Chicago at Steppenwolf, but you know, sort of started in July, in San Francisco at ACT, and have been trying to see, you know, a lot of theater, whether it's across the bay or up a hill or, you know, I'm off to see Lauren Yee's King of the Yees at SF Playhouse tonight.
Oh, great.
As well as, you know, programming for next season, as well as, you know, seeing this season that I selected through. We're in rehearsal with Lauren on another play of hers called The Great Leap. So how exciting to have, you know, two stories of hers back to back within three blocks of each other.
And which both occur, the stories occur in
San Francisco.
Which is really cool.
Which is really cool. And it feels like there's definitely an appetite. Like, I think San Francisco likes stories where they see their neighborhood or where they see themselves. Maybe all places like that
a little bit.
Sort of like the Chicago story is done in Chicago, you know, and the Bay Area story is realized here first. Like I think people like that. You know, so I'm experiencing, well, what are some really interesting Bay Area stories? Who are those Bay Area people that, you know, I want to produce? And, you know, and I also, like, we have the Strand Theater, smaller, you know, a smaller room. You know, what are the stories sort of maybe perhaps better realized there versus the Geary 1,000-seat Jewel Box Beaux-Arts building, that kind of thing. And, you know, and first, like, Lauren Yee's The Great Leap, we thought to produce it in the Strand Theater, and then we decided, no, let's produce it in the Geary. And it's a big baseball play. The language is really rich. It's also a San Francisco story, so I think there's appetite for that. So I'm leaning into that. It's a test balloon, but that's where I'm leaning.
Yes.
And then, you know, I'm still trying to figure out, I mean, I do think there's something in, this is sort of like early generic audience take that, and I think this is true, especially in like Midtown Manhattan, that audiences like to solve things.
Mm.
They like to understand stuff, like from the get-go, and they don't want to be conned. And, you know, there's something like, you know, sort of like trying to like, well, what's okay, if there's something that feels symbolic, what is it an analog for? You know, and so I'm trying to work through what that is. And, you know, I'm interested in, like, you know, I'm interested in, yes, I have an analytical mind as well, but I'm also really interested in theater as an event and theater as something that we're going through in living time. And I try, and sometimes you just have to lower barriers to do it, but like try to like like assume that the artist's work that I'm participating in is built with big intent, is built like step by step to be encountered in that living time. And if I don't get it, quote unquote, like immediately, that it's still worth going through.
Yeah.
Like the event of theater.
Yeah.
As opposed to like, oh, okay, let me try to crack the code of what is going on. And if I haven't cracked the code in 10 minutes, I'm going to start to put up barriers. And I'm just curious how, as a theater community, how we talk about that stuff. Like my mother was a, and actually still is, but is a docent at the Albright Knox Art Gallery in Buffalo, New York, and there's a great contemporary and modern collection. And so as a docent, you know, you walk around and you have these amazing canvases and these amazing sculpture, and you try to sort of it's not so much about imparting, you know, well,
right.
what is this thing? But you try to like have a conversation about that winds up being about like learning to look, you know, learning to step in to it, something at first that might feel like discomforting and, you know, sort of like I'm out of my zone.
Yes.
And I really, you know, I really am interested as an artistic director in a very educated, tech industry, problem-solving city to, like, how can we, like, what is the analog for learning to look so that we can really embrace big stories that maybe shouldn't be tidy and neat,
right,
and knowable in those first 5 minutes.
The questions are more important sometimes than the answers.
Yeah, yeah, and sort of come out the other side of, you know, I've had some talkbacks where people, you know, want to talk about like one element of the show and sort of tiptoe into what they got out of it. And at the end of their tiptoe, they've said something really beautiful, but then turn it back to me as, you know, sort of as lead artist on it or even moderator of the talkback and ask, is that right? And dear God, I mean, there is no right and wrong. That you, oh my God, you just shared something amazing. And that's what you, after 2 hours, are now thinking about. And maybe tomorrow morning you'll think about it differently. But how great that you're thinking about it. That's all I care about.
Yes.
It's not the right and wrong.
How different is that experience from like a commercial Broadway experience that you've had? Is it quite different, or do you find those opportunities to have those kind of exchanges?
No, you know, and that I guess was sort of a leading impulse to want to come here and be an artistic director, is to really engage with an audience. And really engage with an audience over time with multiple stories, whether it's, you know, curating a season or whether it's thinking, well, 5 years out, where do we want to be? And kind of where the we becomes the community.
Right.
As much as the we becomes the staff, as much as the we is the guest artist. You know, the guest artist pool, whether it's national, whether it's local, it's the we in this city. And there is something. I mean, Broadway's fun. Also, Broadway will always be there. You know, I don't feel like I've necessarily said goodbye to Broadway. It isn't about engaging with audiences. You know, I don't know who those people are.
Right. Yeah. What do you have a sense of like what the why of Broadway is?
The why of Broadway is to make money for my investors.
Yeah.
And the why of Broadway for an artist is to work at a really interesting scale, or, you know, to see, I mean, the first several shows of mine on Broadway weren't built for Broadway, and it just felt like there was like going from Playwrights Horizons, 199 seat theater, you know, and then Bruce Norris's play Clybourne Park did really well in London, with productions not directed by me. And then his play won the Pulitzer. And then there was this momentum to like, oh, we want to see that production again. And the way to see it again is to do it at a bigger scale.
Yes.
And, you know, and similarly, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, starting at Steppenwolf Theater, not built for Broadway. But, you know, there was, it was, you know, sort of deemed such an interesting and, you know, sort of emotionally true production of it that a commercial producer was like, I want to see that. I want to share that with, you know, my constituents. You know, so we wound up doing it at the Booth Theater in Broadway. But
it's a great production.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so you know, and I feel very, very, you know, grateful to have the opportunity to direct, you know, those productions again at a different scale with more people getting to see it, with open-ended runs, you know, all that great, great fun stuff. And then, you know, also the other plays that I've done on Broadway, yeah, were like, you know, Heidi Chronicles, A Delicate Balance, Parisian Woman by Bo Willimon. I mean, they had, you know, sort of like for instance, The Parisian Woman, it's a title character, so let's find that great, you know, title character woman who can certainly be a star. And how great for me to get to work with Uma Thurman, who was just like the bee's knees and could be a title character.
Yes.
You know, so I feel very, you know, happy to have, you know, sort of experienced and gone through like building some of those shows for those rooms. I mean, you know, the other thing is like I like that scale.
Yeah.
And so, and that's also what the Geary Theater at ACT can afford me. Like, that was another reason to, like, why this theater?
Yes.
I like the size of those rooms. They feel now, you know, with Seascape being, like, room, like production 9, if I've done 8 Broadway shows in big Beaux Arts houses, and now the Geary Seascape 9, they actually feel very intimate to me. Yeah. Like, they do actually feel like playhouses.
Yes.
And because they're stacked, I don't, you know, I like
it's cozy.
It's weirdly cozy. The acoustics are great, you know, and I'm just, you know, I'm eager to, and I also think there are some plays that actually are illuminated by having 600 to 900 people witness and participate in the story.
Yeah.
That if you actually put them in the small space, that it like the audience experience actually isn't as fun, isn't as like hysterical and like organically full as the big house experience.
Yeah.
You know, and I also think there's like, you know, I like going back and forth, but I also think like the if the text on the page, both in terms of like big idea and like visceral language that demands that you use your body sometimes to speak it, that kind of acting in that bigger room is also really compelling to
me. Yeah.
And it can be a naturalism,
but
there's something on your toes about it that I get really jazzed by.
Yeah. Yeah, there's like a dilation and a transmission that is really different.
And just feels live.
Yeah. I wanted to switch gears for one second because as part of your AD responsibilities, you are also a leader in the field now. And it's really interesting that I began this podcast right around the time that this huge leadership transition was beginning almost 2 years ago. And now you are part of this leadership transition. And so I just wanted to ask you if you could reflect for a moment on what you think this you know, in the beginning, nobody knew kind of where this transition was going. But now that we're kind of 2 years into it and you're one of the leaders who is taking over one of these institutions, I wonder if you have any thoughts on kind of what is happening to the field as a whole in terms of the new direction the new leaders are bringing, and that you are, as one of those leaders, wanting to bring the field in.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly feel that I've given myself a charge, and the board of ACT has given me the charge. And this is, you know, ACT's large regional theater. We're a Lort A. There aren't many in that category. To, you know, really think rigorously about diversity and inclusion and, you know, wanting the work on the stages as well as sort of larger staffing, whether it's the offices or behind the scenes of our work, to better reflect our country and this very diverse city. And so we talk about that a lot, a lot. And I think more and more theaters are talking about that, and more leaders, you know, take that as a big responsibility and opportunity to, you know, sort of, whether that means, you know, more plays produced by artists of color or women or or reaching out very specifically, I think also to, you know, the artists. Like, I'm also very interested in ACT not having like a town and gown relationship to San Francisco.
Right.
And, you know, and you know, like, for instance, this season doing Men on Boats by Jacqueline Bacos and very specifically saying, oh, I want this to be an all local acting company.
Yes.
Felt very important. And, you know, and even just really selfishly, exciting. But even just selfishly as the new kid in town, you know, I want to see, you know, those 13, you know, women, because there are three understudies, you know, sort of, who are they?
Yes.
I mean, that feels like a really exciting opportunity for, you know, sort of me as like, well, what is this casting pool? And I can invite them into my spaces, my seascape. Three of the four actors are local, Bay Area. And that feels fantastic.
Yes. Behalf of Bay Area actors, I want to thank you so
much. No, but it's, you know, and it's definitely intentional, and it feels like, you know, we all want this to be a thriving arts community. And yes, I want to also, you know, I now get to hire, you know, some great artists that I've gone through time with, you know, that are, you know, sort of maybe more based in New York or Chicago or, you know, that, but I recognize that I'm here and I want like that mix to me just sounds super, super exciting. And I think other ADs are talking about that as well. I mean, I certainly know that, you know, Marissa Wolf is like, what is Portland?
Right.
You know, Hannah Sheriff, what is St. Louis? Yes. Like, you know, she's about to step in there.
Yeah.
And she just announced her season. And like, you know, you want to, you know, honor the legacy, try to understand the legacy, and also, sort of keep on nudging it forward and expanding it and learning, what your city is. I mean, theater is live. Interesting times.
That untapped value of locality seems like something, it's very exciting to see what you're doing with, at least with these casts that have been on your stages. I think we only have time for one more question, and the question that I love to end with is, you know, in the American regional theater in particular, sometimes it seems like there's a very one-size-fits-all way to the way we rehearse and produce shows. Mm. That, you know, maybe it's 3.5 weeks of rehearsal, whether it's a two-hander that's 80 minutes long, or whether it's a Thornton Wilder, you know, 32-character play. But we all seem to kind of shoehorn it into 3.5 weeks of rehearsal, and this is how it kind of moves through our regions or our process. If you had a wish and could work differently than the way we currently work on new plays, if you had like one wish to send to the universe of something that we could try that's outside of that kind of one-size-fits-all way of doing things, is there a particular thing that you have discovered in your work that you're like, oh, if we could just get this opportunity, that would be a great boon to the American theater?
Yeah, I mean, certainly a commitment. It's a very good question. I have felt most rewarding and maybe most rewarded when I've been able to work on a new play multiple times. Mm-hmm. I've done that with a few plays by Itamar Moses, a few plays by Bruce Norris, even my plays with Edward Albee. I mean, some of my early work with Edward was new work.
Right.
And there is a learning curve. In that 3.5 week process, you get to a certain place. I mean, I remember Clyburn Park at Playwrights Horizons, we had 2.5 weeks in the rehearsal hall. And this was an incredibly, you know, overlapping dialogue, huge, huge themes. I mean, we never talk theme because it was all about, like, let's just stage it.
Yes.
And, you know, and it felt actually kind of abusive to my eight actors. I felt like an abuser of, like, you know, they would show up at like 8 a.m., work with multiple ASMs and PAs to pound language into their brains so that we could continue staging.
Yeah.
I remember at Playwrights Horizons for Clybourne Park that we had a little curtain, and at the top of Act Two, they did ostensibly a secular prayer circle of like, oh dear God, you know, here we go. We are so not ready for prime time, and poof, here we go. And curtain up, and got your back. Let's just, you know, spit language hard. You know, almost goes back to that, you know, speak quickly, like want something and speak fast. But, you know, it's, you know, like multiple moments, whether it's like, you know, the reading with the playwright in the room with at least some of the actors who will see it through, you know, into workshop mode with some of those actors continuing on and like building a cohort going through time with multiple touches.
You're doing something like that at the moment, aren't you, with Both Your Houses by Susan Stanton? And it was like at a New Strands reading last year, and then now it's being worked on with the MFAs, with Nina Morita directing.
That's right.
And then I guess it goes maybe to something else after this.
That's right. I mean, ACT's just starting a new commissioning process and really, you know, using the MFA Conservatory as a fact and like a captured company of actors and commissioning playwrights to write for a specific class, but already have a professional theater committed to doing after that MFA production to doing the professional world premiere.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, which feels really exciting and an interesting model.
Yeah.
You know, so to have, you know, playwright in residence, get to know a company of 12 or 13 actors, because that's a class of MFA actors at ACT, write for them specifically. So Both Your Houses is a riff on, it's a community theater basically doing a production of Romeo and Juliet. So it's an onstage, backstage Romeo and Juliet. And then Cal Shakes will do the professional premiere of it with a commitment already.
Great.
These multiple touches, you know, of exploration of, you know, but with institutional commitment behind it, so it doesn't feel like, oh, I hope we get it.
Right.
You know, so it's not like every moment is an audition for more support. It actually is a pipeline that is already en route.
Yeah.
To eventually, sharing it with a larger and larger audience with each go. That feels right.
That's fantastic. I could talk with you all day. We didn't even get to talk about the MFA class very much, but...
And you've worked with them.
And I love working with the MFA students. They're terrific. So in this last moment that we have, I wonder if there's any work that you have coming up as a director that you'd like to let our listeners know about so they can come check it out. You're doing something at the National in London, if we have any listeners in the UK.
Yeah, come out to see that. That opens March 20th. I think runs to, I don't know, mid-May, something like that.
Great.
And that's Bruce Norris's Downstate that started at Steppenwolf Theatre, was built as a co-production, Steppenwolf and the National. And, you know, this is like the fifth play of Bruce's that I've directed, so that feels super personal to me. And then late this spring, I'm directing Lydia Diamond's play Tony Stone at the Roundabout in New York at the Laura Pels. And this is a play that I've been involved with developing for 6 years.
Oh, wow.
So this will be the world premiere production of it. And Tony Stone was the first woman to play professional baseball at the tail end of the Negro Leagues. And this is her story. And she was a real person who knew she was a baseball player. And, you know, obviously this is pre-Title IX.
Yeah.
You know, she was a professional ball player in the early 50s for the Indianapolis Clowns. She grew up in the Twin Cities. She lived in San Francisco for a lot of years. She retired to Oakland And she's in the Baseball Hall of Fame, but nobody knows her.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time. And I look forward to seeing you in the future.
Nice.
Bye. Bye.
This podcast was brought to you by SDCF, Stage Directors and Choreographers Foundation. SDCF acknowledges and extends a very special thanks to its 2018-2019 leading contributors, the David Lee Foundation, the Hargrove Pierce Foundation, the Oki Foundation, Trip Coleman, Sheldon Epps, Linda Hartzell, Doug Hughes, and Thomas Kale for their support this season. SDCF events and programs are designed to offer access, opportunity, and community to directors and choreographers at all levels of career. To find out more, visit our website at www.sdcfoundation.org.